Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Hello there and good morning. On today's show, it's a celebration of some remarkable women. As 2018 draws to a close, we'll be looking back in a momentous year for women in the company of Vicky Phelan. Also, the writers of the brilliant Oh My God, What a Complete Aisling, Emma McGlyzett and Sarah Breen, lifelong feminist Alva Smith, and women's aid advocate and domestic violence survivor Jessica Bowes. Our text number is 51551. You can email Miriam at rt.ie and you can find me on Twitter at Miriam O'Call. Well, good morning to you all. I feel blessed to be in the company of so many amazing women.
Good morning, Miriam.
Good morning.
Morning, Miriam. Vicky Phelan, what a year for you, really. I mean, Vicky Phelan was a private person and now you're probably arguably the most well-known woman in Ireland.
Yeah, it's very strange. Still very strange. I mean, we're now in December, which I, you know, all laughing aside, I really didn't think I'd be here, you know. So, I mean, that's a huge thing for me to be here this Christmas because, you know, last Christmas I was facing into, you know, 6 to 12 months, and I really thought 12 months was the limit, you know, as in December. And I thought I'd be really sick and probably in some hospice at this stage. So I'm not, far from it, to be honest, you know, which is great.
You're looking fantastic.
Yeah. But it's been, oh yeah, and I mean, it's mental. You know, this is not why, you know, I did what I did. It's come along with the territory, unfortunately. And it's lovely, you know, but I am, you know, I actually would rather be a private person. I'm not really used to all of this attention. I mean, it's gone to the point now where, you know, even on a train, you know, people come up and in the hospital when I'm walking down the corridors. But it's lovely. I mean, it is lovely. But you do see the difference it makes to people. I mean, I get some people coming up to me and they're crying, you know, hugging me, and they're in tears and floods of tears. And a lot of men, which I really kind of wasn't expecting. I kind of expected the women, but I wasn't expecting the men. And that kind of floored me, really. You know, a lot of very private men who maybe have lost their wives or who didn't get the opportunity, or whose wives were too quiet to talk or open up, you know. So it's lovely. And I'm glad I did it for the people who are very quiet in this country and who won't stand up. They're the people I'm doing this for.
Yeah. But you are a remarkable person. Like, you've come into our studio today to be with us straight from hospital.
Yeah. Straight from treatment. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I know I'm mental, to be honest, because, you know,
we're glad you're mental.
You know, no, but I tell you, it's very strategic and very kind of logistical, because my son hates me being away for too long. And last week was a crazy week. I was up here practically every day last week in Dublin. So this week I said, right, I'm only coming up for treatment, so I'll just squash in as much as I can and get it all done so I can go home.
Alva Smith, it must have meant a lot for you in the day, because for decades, Alva, you have been campaigning, I suppose, for that referendum.
Absolutely, campaigning to remove that obstacle from the Constitution. It was an incredible year and it was an incredible victory which turned the tables around in Ireland. And I think it really has done something incredibly significant. I have to say, I felt and still actually feel very emotional about it, because it was, I think, a year in which so much emotion was expressed, so many feelings were expressed in a country which needed desperately to be able to speak out about damage and pain that had been done, and to be able to do it in a positive way. And that makes me feel very relieved that we've been able to do this in Ireland, but also, I can't tell you, incredibly proud. I am going to cry, probably. Incredibly proud of the women around this table, the women who fought so hard for the referendum alongside men. I feel really proud for the people of Ireland that we made a good decision. I couldn't feel prouder of being Irish in Ireland this year. And quite honestly, in 72 years, it's the first time I'm able to say that without a bit of a doubt. It's not that we don't have a huge amount to do, but we have a great base and we have fantastic people. The young people of this country are second to none, absolutely second to none. And the women of Ireland, Manana Héireann, oh my God, just give us this country for a week and we'll turn it around even more.
And I'm conscious, suppose, of people who didn't vote in the way that obviously the referendum ended. But I know you down the years, Alva, you're very sensitive to that. So you don't believe in, like, you know, imposing your will. You're just saying it's a
choice. Absolutely. It was a very democratic process, and certainly in Together for Yes, we really observed that democracy. I don't feel any bitterness or ill will of any kind. I think we had a very fair referendum campaign and a very fair vote, and the people made a decision. Mm. Two-thirds of the people decided. But that is not to say that we are all of one mind, or that we ever will be of one mind, or that we ever should be of one mind. We are a very diverse people, and long may we reign as such. But we have nonetheless, I think, struck a great blow for freedom, for honesty, and for speaking up and speaking out when it needs to be done. And everybody around this table actually bears witness to that.
Just to your right there, I suppose, Emer and Sarah, you two wrote the biggest bestseller, Oh My God, What a Complete Aisling. You followed it up this year with a follow-up. Well, you've written about an extraordinary woman, Aisling, but Vicky is an extraordinary person, isn't she?
Oh, absolutely. It's a privilege to be sitting here next to her. We're thrilled to meet her.
It really is. We can't believe we're sitting around this table with these American women, or these unbelievable women. It's just, like, we can't believe it.
We're in good company.
Yeah, we feel a bit like charlatans.
Well, you've had an amazing year. Again, just winning Fiction Book of the Year at the Irish
Popular
Book Awards.
Fiction, yeah, that was very unexpected. We were against Graham Norton, and when we realized he was actually coming to the event, we were like,
we were
no
just excited
chance.
To be breathing the same air as Graham.
Yeah. He was actually at the next table. It was thrilling. And then to actually win the award just blew our tiny minds. Yeah. We were amazed.
To remind people, though, who don't know Emer, how did the book come about, Oh My God, What a Complete Aisling?
Well, Sarah and I have been friends for years and years. And about 10 years ago, we were messing, as we are wont to do. And we came up with this character of Aisling. We were sharing a little flat in Stony Batter, and we just started messing about this girl, attributing her various kind of characteristics. And we set up a Facebook page so that we didn't lose any of the kind of jokes we were telling each other and our friends. Fast forward 10 years, and Gill Books, which is a great Irish publisher, approached us and said, would you think about putting something on paper about Aisling? They probably intended it to be kind of a Christmas gift book or something you could put in a stocking. And we said, actually, we'd like to do a novel. And they said yes, and we went, oh Jesus,
now we have to write a novel. And we were literally Googling, can two people write a novel? Is this a crazy idea?
What is first person?
But we came up with a sort of general plot line, which became the plot for Oh My God, What a Complete Aisling. Yeah. And they loved it, and we set about doing it, and it became extremely successful.
And for the one person in the country who might not have read it, tell them what the plot line is.
Okay, so we have Aisling, our sort of Irish everywoman, and she is living this life of quiet desperation. She's waiting for the proposal from her long-term boyfriend, so she gets a French manicure every time they go on a weekend away. She's ready
for the Instagram photos,
ready to put it up on Facebook. And when that doesn't happen, she's kind of catapulted into this situation where she has to sort of forge a new life for herself, and she ends up moving to Dublin and moving in with some quite notiony flatmates. And comedy ensues along the way.
And then in the second book, which came out just a couple of months ago, The Importance of Being Aisling, we pick up she's in a good enough spot. But she finds herself through a series of unfortunate events. She loses her job and has to move back from Dublin back down home. So many of us have spent so long travelling up to Dublin and back down home. And she's faced with a new set of challenges. And we've just loved kind of going on this journey with her. Sounds kind of sappy, but we really have, and we miss her. Now that we've finished writing the two books, we have to write a third, but we're looking forward to getting back into it.
We have to get on that any day now.
And it could be turned into a movie. Is it with Element Pictures?
Yeah, we are currently writing. We are currently writing the screenplay. We're working with Element Pictures, which is amazing.
Yeah,
it's one of the things we probably would have joked about when we were first writing the book. We would have been like, "God, imagine like Marion Keyes knew we wrote a book, and then she was one of its biggest champions. Imagine we were allowed to write a screenplay, and here we are,
trying to get it done." And it's a completely different beast to writing a book, because in a book you have endless time and space to like put in your little anecdotes and funny stories, but with a film it's much more linear, and you have to try and so we're trying to sort of compress the book into 90 funny, nice minutes, and we're finding it tricky.
But we'll get there.
We'll get there. We always do.
And it's funny you mentioned Marion, because some of the references in your book are quite Irish. The way Marion has referenced, like you've been referenced to Frances Brennan, but you left those in even though there's a UK audience as well.
Yeah. I mean, we're big fans of Frances.
Who wouldn't be? Absolutely.
With the fancy hotel and the sheets and everything. And it's like a real honour to be compared to Marion Keyes, because she is such an amazing example of a woman who has not diluted her Irishness, and still her books have travelled all over the world. Yeah. And that's what we hope for our Aisling. Well, we actually have deals now in Germany, Korea, Serbia. Yeah, Jesus. I don't know if they're going to get it, but fingers crossed.
Marion's been such a great champion for women, and she's unashamedly like positive about women's fiction and popular fiction, and it's just a real boost, and it gives like women like us kind of the confidence to go ahead and go, read our books.
No, she's a wonderful role model. Yeah, and I'm going to come back to you, Vicky, because you actually have a book coming out, but I want to bring in Jessica Bowes. Jessica, thank you so much for being here as well. For any of my listeners, Jessica, who don't remember, I mean, one, I'll tell them that I first came across you on Primetime because you were a survivor of domestic violence, and you did an interview with me which went completely viral, like almost 2 million people have watched it. But for people who don't know, tell us a little about yourself, because since then you've become an advocate for women's aid and become very empowered, haven't you?
Yeah, I think I've become like, I think they call it an accidental advocate. I didn't mean to kind of become one, but then I started sharing my story and people were responding to it, and the helpline was kind of blowing up a little bit and they were getting lots of hits on their website, and I knew people were reaching out. Then people started reaching out to me. They were contacting me on social media and coming up to me on like on the street. People were coming into me in work and like coming off all from different departments to come down and have chats with me and tell me stories about like cousins that they were concerned about or friends that they were worried about, and just asking me for advice really. And it kind of ballooned from there, and every time I do something like this I always say this will be the last thing I do, because it takes a lot out of you. And I was thinking of Vicky earlier and how like you've come here from treatment and you're still to manage your family and your kids and travelling up and down, and how exhausting it can be, but also how powerful it is when you do speak. And I think we saw that too in the repeal movement. People were sharing their stories on the, we had a Facebook page,
In Her Shoes,
that's right. And some of the stories were so powerful that I think people started to talk. There's been so much talk this year. Everybody's kind of, you can see it everywhere. People are not afraid and they're not ashamed, and they actually realise that it's quite liberating as well when you do speak out, and that you're encouraging other people to speak out. And it does actually have a positive impact, even though it can be quite hard and it can be a bit draining at times, like opening old wounds. But yeah, I suppose the pros outweigh the cons with something like this.
In a way though, of all the people around the table here who've spoken out, yours could arguably be the toughest, because people always say when you're in a domestic violence situation that a lot of time women cover it up, that I don't know if it's fear. When you look back now, why do you think, I suppose, any woman listening this morning who's in one of those relationships, why they stay in it and why it's so difficult to get out of it? Is it that society doesn't want to talk about it?
I think the first problem is a lot of women don't even realise that they're being abused. Like people will say to me, oh, he doesn't hit me, but he does this and he does that and he says these things to me and he's really mean. And but that's abuse too. A lot of it is still abuse, you know, and that's the start. And, you know, that's where you're stumbling at the first kind of, that's your first hurdle, is that you have to accept that you're being abused. And for a lot of women, they don't actually realise that they're being abused. And I think it's the language that we use can be quite damaging when we speak to each other, because if one of my friends comes to me and gives out about her boyfriend, I might say to her, oh, look, don't mind him, you know. Just, you know, I might call him a few names or whatever. I can't say on the radio. But like, we don't say to each other, that's not OK, that's abuse. Like, we just don't do it. It's not in our language every day to say, oh, look, that's abuse, or that's, you know, that's wrong. You can't allow that to continue, or you deserve better than that. We kind of just listen and sympathise with each other, and then we kind of move on from it, because it's a lot of people don't want to get involved that deeply in your relationship either. So you're kind of trying to manage it on your own, and people don't say it to you either. And then by the time they do, you're probably in so deep that you feel like there's no going back. You're living in fear and you're living under threat, and you've probably tried to leave without telling anybody you're leaving, and you've felt the consequence of that. So you just get further and further kind of into the trap of it, and it gets harder to leave, you know.
But I think that's really, just listening to Jessica and to Vicky and also to Emer and Sarah, one of the things that strikes me is that this has been a really remarkable year, where so many silences have been broken, where so many secrets have been opened up, and where women particularly have said, we are not living in this secrecy anymore. We're going to speak up and tell the truth. You stood up, Vicky, and told the truth. You did the same thing, Jessica. And, you know, in Aisling, what we have, I think, is a woman who's very funny. She doesn't mean to be, but she's very real. There's something about that sense of, we've had enough with the nonsense. We've had enough with the the rubbish. We've had enough with putting things under the carpet. And we're just saying, actually, there are realities in our lives that we have to speak about. And they also have political repercussions, mm-hmm. not providing services, mm-hmm. not telling women what they need to know in terms of their health, that we have to be telling the truth about these things. And I think that every time a woman speaks up now, that it resonates with all the other women. Yeah. And women are saying, actually, that silence is gone. It's finished. And yeah. I do think, you know, 2018, 100 years after women got the vote, vote oil 100 this year, that's over now. We're not going to be keeping quiet ever again. And that is hugely changing. That is revolutionary mm-hmm. in a society because yeah. it doesn't go back in a box.
No.
None of you are going back in a box. None yeah. of us. And it gives great courage and heart to other women, and even listening to Voices for Choice, it's so positive mm-hmm. at the same time. Yes, they're really, really difficult yeah. things, but there is something really positive because it is healthy and good for us to be speaking up, and that changes who we are, I think.
Yeah.
I just feel so grateful mm-hmm. well, to you.
Yeah, I mean,
looking
I suppose
at Vicky and Jessica and you two for writing the smashing book, to have had the get up and go and the courage to do all of that. You know, it's really
Yeah, but
really
people
matters.
Like you led the way, Alva,
yeah,
to be honest.
Paved the way for
no,
the rest
people
of us.
Here are
many,
only
many,
doing what
many
we're doing
women
with you.
Over the years. Many, many layers and layers and layers of us. I just happen, I think, to have a bit of something or another that's very stubborn. That I'm still here.
That makes two of us.
All of us around here. But truly, I mean, I've worked with women over the past year and 2 years and 5 years. All of them, you know, have been around for really quite a very long time. And I think that also needs to be recognised, that it's been a very hard struggle for us in this country over the generations to get to the point where, you know, you can speak up, Jessica, and yeah. actually say, now this, we have to really take strong measures here. And where, Vicky, you're looking at a situation, you're thinking, this is absolutely not right. However yeah. private I am, I have to do something. So it's about getting that courage, joining up all the courage, mm-hmm. really is one way, I yeah. suppose, of thinking about it.
You would want to come in there a minute ago, Vicky.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree with Alva. I do think, you know, the reason I did what I did was to give people hope, you know, actually. And I think that's what the referendum has given us. Mm-hmm. And that's what you're giving to other women that are in your situation. And that's what I want to give to other women, to the hope and kind of, you know, positivity that even though this is bad, you know, there is hope that, you know, I suppose my thing is two prongs. You know, it's women in my situation with the terminal illness, to give them hope that there are other drugs and treatments out there yeah. that, you know, if you're given this prognosis, it's not always the end,
yeah.
you know, that you have to have in my situation. If you don't have that little glimmer of hope, you know, yes. you will die. I yeah. mean, I've seen it happen where, you know, somebody is told, you know, you've got 6 to 12 months, and they go home and they're dead within 6 to 12 months because they don't think that, you know, there's you know, more time. And if your body accepts that, you know, to a certain extent, that is what's going to happen. So I suppose that was my big thing, to be honest. I never thought my court case would take off like it did. Mm. My scandal for me, I suppose, was the fact that I was given this terminal prognosis, and I have two young kids, and I was going to fight damn hard to make sure that I was going to, you know, get extra time. But the other side of it too, with the women in the cervical check scandal, as that got bigger and bigger, and now that we've set up this support group, was to give women in that situation hope that, I suppose I had a lot of time to digest what had happened outside of the media. A lot of women found out about this after my court case. So, you know, they had a double whammy, really. They found out in the media and then had to deal with everything that they were hearing in the media as well, which was sensationalised in some cases. But, you know, there are women I've met through the support group. You know, you think my situation is bad. I remember one lady coming up to me, and I know we spoke about this when I did the interview with you, Miriam, back in April. And I said to you, well, look, you know, I just felt that I needed to talk about the whole sex thing. It's a bit like, you know, the taboo yeah. subjects that we don't feel yeah. we can talk about. Like one of the things with cervical cancer, I thought, well, if I can go as graphic as I can about my experience and how it's affected my sex life, you know, it'll help other people. Mm. Two things. It will help the women in my situation to think, oh my God, I'm not on my own. And also, you know, it will hopefully scare other people into the doctors to go have their smears, because you don't want to have this cancer, you know. And this lady came up to me, one of the women affected in the group, because when we had our first day of our launch, I spoke first. And I said, right, I said to Stephen Slarius, I'm going to go all at this Full Metal Jacket now, talk about sex. And he went, oh, Jesus, she's off again, you know. But, you know, he understood, you know, because he thought, well, it's going to look better, you know, and they'll appreciate it coming from you. And this
Is
girl,
that Stephen Teep?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we had this discussion, and he said he himself and Irene would have had the same problems when she was going through her treatment, and she was only 35 when she died. So you can imagine, you know, I mean, having no sex life in your 30s, I mean, you know, Jesus. But this girl came up to me afterwards. She was only 32. And when she was diagnosed with cervical cancer, she didn't have a boyfriend or a partner. So she gets this diagnosis, goes off and has all her treatment. And the treatment is horrendous. You know, in some cases, some women can have a sex life again. In most cases, they can't. This girl can't have sex again because they did surgery that shortened her vagina, narrowed her vagina. And like, she's out now trying to meet somebody. And like, she just broke down. I got so upset because I thought, here she is, beautiful 32-year-old girl. Hasn't got a boyfriend, and she says to me, Vicky, how am I going to go and meet somebody? How do you have that conversation with the man when sex is off the table? Do you, you know, that's I just terrible. Don't think people realise the extent of the damage that this cancer has on your body, on your sense of being a woman even, you know, because that's taken away from you, and you're hitting early menopause at 30 or 40. Or, do you know, it's horrendous, horrendous. Yes. So I just felt I needed to come out and talk about it because then it might help other people, and that's kind of what's happened.
But your honesty... helped, in other words, that 32-year-old woman. Because probably no one else would bring it up with her.
No, she never spoke about it to anybody except for her doctor or the oncology nurse who hands you the... I told the story about being handed, you get the, handed these little bag. You can write this in one of your books. You get handed this little bag of dilators. Stephen will kill me now when I say this, but he actually called them defibrillators. Well, I nearly went myself laughing. They're dilators. So they're like these little white plastic tubes. So like I was saying, Jesus, you think they give you something like, you know,
what
rampant
do you do
rabbit.
With them?
So they're literally like hard... They're in different sizes, so you start with the smallest size, and what you're supposed to do is go home when you've had all your radiation, and you're supposed to use lubricant, and literally it's to stretch your vagina, because, you know, in the beginning, after all the radiation, it really narrows down, so you're supposed to use these dilators to widen your vaginal canal, basically, for two reasons, if you want to have sex again, but also for your doctor, to make it easier for him to have an internal examination.
But it's certainly a year in which actually the men of Ireland have also had to take cognizance of and be aware of women's sexuality and sex lives. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's also an incredibly good thing. Because, I mean, who ever talked very openly about sex in this
Nobody.
Country? But completely prohibited, which was really prohibited, forbidden, whatever. And I just think that's so important. I mean, certainly during the repeal campaign, there were many times when you'd be trying to work out the date, when do you start the 12-week period. This was a great discussion we had. I won't name any names, but there was a bunch of men around a table and they were having to talk about periods and menstruation. And their faces were scarlet. Yeah. Their faces were scarlet. The women were sitting back thinking, that's very good, but they have to do this now. Yeah. But that's so important. It's so ridiculous to have a world in which people won't talk about
bodily
sex.
Functions, yeah. Bodily,
you know. And vaginas on the radio, for example.
And on that note, on this Sunday morning, I'm going to take a break. Join us in a few moments.
Tweet at Miriam O'Cal. Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. I'm here this morning with a group of remarkable women to celebrate them and the year that was 2018. It was a momentous year for women. Here with me are Vicky Phelan, the writers of the brilliant Oh My God, What a Complete Ashling, Emer McLeod and Sarah Breen, lifelong feminist Alva Smith, and women's aid advocate and domestic violence survivor Jessica Bowes. For both of you, Emer and Sarah, apart from everything else we've been speaking about in the past part of the show, it was the year of Me Too as well. Mm-hmm. And so much has been written about Me Too because obviously it was essential. It needs to keep going. But does it occasionally go too far? You know, the way some people say, most men, most of us know, are actually very nice. Would that be correct to say?
I overheard somebody on the Lewis yesterday complaining about, you know, is flirting going to be illegal soon because of the Me Too movement? And I just thought, if you're that bad at flirting, you know, you're doing it wrong. So I don't think it's gone too far, but I think maybe people need to get better at flirting.
Yeah, the emphasis on this idea that all men are going to be afraid to do anything. I mean, the fear of women and what's happened to women over decades, centuries, far outweighs any man going, oh, I'm afraid to say hello to a woman in case she thinks I'm, you know, trying to do something to her. The balance just isn't there. So I don't think it's definitely hasn't gone too far yet. Anyway, maybe we'll see where it goes. But a much needed movement.
Yeah, and interesting in your case, Vicky, I mean, I know I've met your husband with you. He's an incredibly supportive guy, isn't he? Stephen Teep, you mentioned there, who was wonderful. His wife Irene passed away from cervical cancer. But I suppose, is there a danger, as everyone's probably shouting at the radio at Miriam, is there a danger maybe that we frighten off young men or not? I mean, I have sons and daughters, and my sons are as nice as my daughters. Is that a strange thing to say?
On the repeal campaign, there were loads and loads and loads of young men, and older men too, actually, and they're all fantastic. Yeah. Those young men aren't frightened. In fact, they're very respectful, and they actually learn from young women. So they're more able, I think, to do that. And I think that that's actually what we need. And I mean, I can also say to you quite honestly that since the day I became an activist, which is so long ago, I've forgotten what the day was, I have been told I'm going too far because I'm a woman, I'm a feminist, and I'm speaking up for women. And people say, oh, do you not think that's going a bit far? And I'm looking at what's happening to women in their lives in this country, even as we speak, and all around the world. And I'm thinking, not anywhere near far enough. We haven't gone anywhere near far enough yet.
Mm. Yeah, I think we're only scratching the surface really still, to be honest.
Mm. And I mean, yes, most men are great. And, you know, the likes of your son, like most men are great. And those great men need to eclipse the men who aren't so great and speak up when they see things their friends are doing that they don't like, or if they see something happening, not to just kind of shy away and go, that's not my problem. Mm. You know, the good men need to, you know, continue being good, maybe be a bit better.
Yeah, I feel like you can, there's a bit more presence now online, especially from the good men. They're kind of stepping up and speaking up and being very supportive of different things that are kind of trending online. When you read through the conversations, there's just a change slightly in the narrative where they're speaking out a little bit more. They want us to know that they're there. You know, you can see that they're stepping up. I can see them definitely on my page. I have a little Facebook page and I get men contacting me all the time, you know, just kind of giving me words of encouragement and commenting on things and saying how awful, you know, the whole situation was. And yeah, I can definitely see that they're kind of, they want to be heard in that they're good men and they're kind of putting their hands up and saying, we're here. You know, you
but
can't
that's,
see
that's
it.
Very good. And at the same time, we need to be very clear that it's women who need the support. I mean, when we're talking about violence against women, it's the women. We don't need to be out there protecting the men or speaking up for them or minding them or telling them they're great or anything. What we need to be doing is looking at what is actually happening to women. So I think men also really have to understand that there is a massive problem still with gender relations, to, you know, give it its kind of official word, and that a lot of sorting out needs to go on, and it has to go through our education system and all sorts. But really, there can be a tendency to run and sort of want to protect men. But men have demonstrated that they're pretty good at getting what they want. I think, I mean, just thinking of you, Vicky, and actually yourself too, Jessica, that the impact women like you have on speaking out on government, which is still mainly male, that is phenomenal. I mean, that's going to shift the policies along, because those men hear what you're saying. They can't not listen to it.
No. Well, I won't go away, and they know I won't go away. You know. But I take your point, because I remember when I was going in to meet the Taoiseach, and remember we spoke about this, Miriam, and I remember his private secretary rang me a couple of days beforehand to ask me who was coming with me, and I thought, well, why would anyone be coming with me? I'm coming on my own. And I thought that was a strange question. Would he have asked that of a man? Think about it. I don't think he would. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
And I just thought, no. And I had this conversation with my solicitor, and I said, do I need to bring someone with me? I said, because I actually want to go in there and stand there on my own in front of him and kind of say, right, Leo, you know, can we have a chat here, citizen to citizen, not, you know, Taoiseach to do you know what I mean? So I felt it was the right thing to do for me. I just thought, no, I'm a woman here, and you need to be able to stand with me here without me having to have somebody by my side, you know? Yes.
But Alva's right. As, you know, at the end of 2018, as we look back, by standing up you, Vicky, you changed so many things. And also the fact that you weren't prepared to accept that there was no treatment for you. To remind people, you researched yourself and found that Pembro drug, didn't you? So the great thing is, through your campaigning for Pembro, other women are going to get it, not just the women who were the 221 in the cervical smear controversy.
Yes, yeah. So this is going to be made available to all women with cervical cancer, because I felt terrible that this drug was being made available to me. but not being made available to other women in my situation. And most of these women, you know, and I think that needs to be pointed out, is that they're all young women, you know, like me. Most of them are actually younger with very small kids. And here's me getting this drug and they're not. I mean, that's not fair. That's not equitable. Mm-hmm. Yes, there was a moral obligation on the government to you know, pay for medication and treatment for the women affected by the scandal. But, you know, there are very small numbers, to be honest. And I made that point to Simon Harris at the time. I said, you know, as far as I'm aware, and again, we're depending on figures from the HSE, there's a very small number of women who are terminally ill in the 221 group. Most of them are either finished treatment or, you know, are in remission. So, I was asking my oncologist, because he was trying to get access to this drug for other women. And we had a chat and he said, look, Vicky, you're after doing so well getting this drug for yourself. He said, I wonder, would you give me some help in trying to get access to this for other women? He said, because I think it's very unfair that this is being made available to, you know, one section of the population, but not the other. And I said, I totally agree with you, because lots of these women were contacting me for information on how to go about it. So, I mean, I couldn't sit and kind of watch these women die, you know, or not have access to these drugs when it's here and it's made by a company in this country. It's so I just thought, no, this is another thing now I have to, you know, stand up.
You know, I'm just thinking of Jessica, because you're working really as a voice and advocate with Women's Aid now, and how that is hugely powerful, because, I mean, what you did was really quite remarkable and quite extraordinary. But that you're doing that actually enables Women's Aid then to be pushing even more strongly with government for the resourcing that we need for the services for women all around the country.
Yeah.
You know,
we had the launch of the Femicide Watch 2 weeks ago in the Rotunda, and I got to meet the commissioner there.
And Drew Harris.
Yeah. And we spoke, and I basically said, you know, I had outlined the experience that I had had and that I had tried to get help from the guards and that they weren't always very helpful. And They've set up a pilot project out in Ballymun. They invited me out to that last year and I went out, and they have like a protective services unit out there, but they have a policy of zero tolerance with a breach of a barring order, which is what would have probably saved me if I had called the guards the first time and they arrested him for breaching the order. He may have felt that there was going to be some consequence for what he was doing and he may have just left me alone, you know, and I never got that reaction. I never got that response. It was really bad trying to get any kind of help, and then you're trying to manage it on your own. But he has said now that by the end of next year, they'll have rolled out a protective service unit for every district in Ireland. So hopefully...
That's amazing. Yeah. Well, considering how long it's taken and other organisations.
Which is your point, Ava. It matters so much. And of course, just to let my listeners know, Chris, the partner who did beat you up is in prison.
Well, he's out now. He was released in September. Oh, so... Yeah.
Okay. Oh my God.
Yeah. So it's more important now for me than it ever was to keep pushing my agenda with the guards, because I know there's so many women out there and they're making the calls, and it takes a bit of courage to do that and to get your bar in order and to go into court and face them in court, and you don't get the, you know, the privacy of in camera or any of that. You have to go in and stand in the same room as them, to explain to the judge you're at the judge's mercy. You know, you might not get the order. You'll have to leave then with no order, and there might be consequences for you being there in the first place. But if you do get the order, that you should have the protection that's supposed to come with it. But he used to say to me, you know, oh, it's just a piece of paper, you know, what good is it? Because it was just a piece of paper without any enforcement. You can have all the legislation in the land, and if the guards aren't going to come in and step in and help you when you pick up the phone and make that call, then like it's not going to work. We need a full-time
and I know
response.
Like Vicky's saying, people have come up to her, like that young woman who said it really helped her that you'd spoken out, because I was at that Women's Aid conference a few months back and you were speaking and I saw women go up to you. I mean, there are women who've gone up to you and said, you have enabled me to speak out, haven't they?
I got a mail on Facebook from a girl who had come over last Christmas. She came home from London and she visited her mum in Galway. And her mum had kept all the newspaper clippings from whatever articles were in the paper, and she read them, and she had to have blood clots cleaned out of the back of her eye from an assault. Which I just thought was horrendous. I'll never leave me the thoughts of that. But she stayed in Galway. She didn't go back to London.
After reading the story.
So a lot of people will contact me and say, oh my God, you know, this is happening to me, and somebody has tagged me in your video, or somebody has, because I'm still getting, I know you said earlier, but there's 3 million views on that video now. It's still, I go in every now and again and check it, and there's like like a tag that day, nearly every day. Somebody's tagging somebody.
It's definitely the biggest kind of prime wonder. Time video ever.
Yeah. Yeah, so
it's so important though. It's because it's making 3 million people who are really aware. Mm. I'm just thinking of the stories during their appeal campaign. Each woman and or each couple that told their story really was empowering another woman or another couple. And we've shown, I think, this year that actually speaking, and I mean, it's been building up over years, but kind of came to a head this year or something.
I think testimonials work for everything, they you know, no matter what domain or sphere.
Yeah.
Testimonials work because it's personal.
That you get when it is. You speak out when people are very supportive of you and compassionate. It changes things, you know. And you could see the compassion, you know, for Vicky, and I can still feel the compassion for me. And you could see it in the repeal movement. Mm-hmm. People were very compassionate. Mm-hmm. Even sometimes they mightn't have agreed with, you know, they might have been on the other side, and they, you know, but they still, a lot of them still had. I know there were kind of moments where we were all being attacked online or whatever, but there was a lot of compassion, and I think that's very encouraging as well. When
there was less attacking in some senses than we might have thought, say, than there was 10 years ago or 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And I think that in itself is an indication that there is a general calming down about women because we're speaking up.
I know we're not going away, Alva.
It's also, as you say, about compassion, about solidarity, women to women as well as men to women. But I'm conscious that Emer and Sarah, you're such a close friendship, haven't you?
Yeah.
Like, you're really bonded as two women.
Yeah.
Well, we're now workmates. We've travelled so much this year because we've done a lot of kind of literary festivals and events talking together. We work together every day in my dining room. So, yeah, we're good friends. We have to be.
It's quite intense. And people are always keen to know, like, what do you argue about? You must have fights.
They're mad
about
for the fights. They're like, what?
Fights about the storyline.
But you probably don't fight.
No. We really don't. Like, I always just say, what do we have to fight about? Like, we come up with our little stories. And the only times maybe we have, you know, we'd question something is if we're on a deadline and we just are churning out words like you wouldn't believe. And, you know, when we read stuff back, it might be like, oh, would Aisling actually
something
say that
might
in that
jar.
Moment?
You might just be like, I just don't know. And if Sarah said to me, I don't know, would Aisling do that? Almost certainly I'll go, you're right. She wouldn't. Yeah, yeah. We just know Aisling so well. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting saying about, you know, Jessica and Alva and Vicky's testimonials, you know, providing so much courage. Obviously, we wrote fiction, but we, you know, covered abortion in the book. And so many people came to us and said that it gave them kind of courage to go and talk to their moms, their grannies or their dads or whatever. And that was a really unexpected thing that happened with us. And it just goes to show what Vicky said. Testimonials are so important. Yeah. But any kind of bit of courage or content that you can go to someone and go, look, this is what's happened, and they can use it to start a conversation is so important. So that's been really great for us, I think.
Yeah.
And that solidarity between women, the friendship and the solidarity, I must say it's been a bedrock in my own life. One way and another. But, you know, this year, people keep saying to us, we're three co-directors of the Together for Yes campaign, Orla O'Connor and Gráinne Griffin and myself. And now people keep saying to us when they're doing articles and interviews, well, you must have had fights. What did you fight about? And we're sitting there saying, actually, we didn't. And they say, but you must have. It was a long campaign. And we're saying, we didn't fight. We actually did not fight. And men simply can't, they can't believe that. They say, but you must have had, and they're looking for a bit of tension and whatnot. And we're saying, no, we didn't. We worked through, we talked. And somebody in a group of three will always stand back and say, no, you're both right anyway, I can't beat you. It was often me, I think, actually. You know, I can't beat you. So you'd just be practical. And I do think that we're very practical when we do things, that we get on with it. My experience is women are really practical and just keep going on, and we're not.
Yeah, I think we you know, I mean, God, you've got 8 kids, Miriam. You know, you have to find solutions, don't you, when you're trying to juggle everything, you know?
Yes. Coming year has to be a year where we've got an awful lot to do, but where actually that's also recognised that women do an awful lot of that kind of care organising.
Yes.
That we the emotional labour. Yeah.
The emotional labour.
I love that emotional labour. Okay.
Feeling it.
And actually, Sarah will be going into labour quite soon, emotional or otherwise.
A different type of labour.
Because you're expecting your third baby.
That's due, he or she is due in February, so we have to make deadlines and make things work, but we always we always work around these things.
Speaking of amazing women, Sarah has two daughters. So the four of us, me, Sarah and her two daughters, have spent so much time together over the past couple of years. And it's like a little coven of like these little girls.
We're
and
a motley crew.
We're like, it takes a village to like, we've had such a lovely time, all us gals. So yeah, I wonder.
Working from home and all that.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
when we look back in 2018, as we come to the end today, if Emer and Sarah, if I was to ask you, I mean, you've had so many highs, of course, but maybe the highs and the lows of 2018, is that difficult? The highs are probably the success you've had, I assume.
Yeah.
All the unexpected things that happened, like, you know, TV producers ringing up and wanting to have cups of coffee with us and going into meetings and people asking us, so what do you guys like to watch and read? And then we start talking and people take notes,
yeah,
which is just like, no, we are just talking.
Probably we were... Like, we're like, we're just messing. We've managed to somehow make a living out of it.
Probably like Michelle Obama, imposter syndrome. You know, yeah, everyone talks about it. Everyone's a bit like that, aren't they?
Probably one of the highs is definitely when we found out that Aisling was going to travel outside of Ireland, we were offered a UK book deal. I mean, not only was that such a boost for people like loving the character we created, but it also gave us the space to make it into a full-time job, which is now what we're doing. Like, it's our full-time job to... And so sometimes you'll say, especially like taxi drivers, they'll be like, do you do that in the evenings? And they're like, no, full-time. So that's probably definitely been our...
And yeah, we feel very lucky because so many writers still have to maintain their day jobs of, you know, working in their open plan offices or whatever. So at the moment we are able to do it full time. I can't think of a low.
I really can't either. It sounds a bit...
We went camping in France and it rained.
It rained, yeah. We even go on holidays together.
Do you really?
Oh my God.
Yeah. That's as bad as it got this year. So that's a good
it
complaint.
Rained in France. It was grand.
I'll go to you next, Alva Smith. I mean...
Oh, the big high, I mean, without question, was the results of the Repeal referendum, because it was just so incredibly stunning. And 2/3 of the people in the highest turnout, blah, 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 etc. It was just absolutely remarkable. And I would be lying through my teeth if I said anything else, because it was really, from my point of view, it was a lifetime win in a way. So, and I just know it means so much to everybody. My personal high, though, was that morning, because the exit polls had come out, my six-year-old granddaughter, Martha, FaceTimed me from London, probably scripted by her mother, actually. And she said, "We hear you're a rebel girl, Granny, and we're very proud of you."
Aww.
I was so proud to be a rebel girl for my granddaughter. Just,
amazing.
I still feel tears coming into my eyes. That meant so much to me on a personal level, because you can lose your personal self in these campaigns, and you have to try very hard to keep a hold of it. What are your own feelings as well as feeling for Ireland, so to speak? And that was my moment of really feeling my family knows that we've done this and that it's good and they're proud of me. And I was so appreciative. I was so grateful. I was so thrilled.
And so well-deserved. Any lows? I mean, was there maybe a moment even during the campaign?
Oh, my God, from... You know, January the 1st, 2018, until basically the 25th of May, I was in a constant state of hyper excitement and tension and worry and anxiety and so on. But we actually did it. But no major lows, actually. No.
Great. For you, Jessica?
Oh, the Repeal has to be, definitely for me, the high. Lows, I actually, I'm struggling to think of one, to be honest.
Great.
I haven't had any lows. I haven't had any lows in a while, actually, Miriam.
Which is so
life is very,
to hear,
very simple now and very easy. And I get up and I go to work and I do my thing with the kids and we go on holidays and life is good. I have no complaints, I have to say.
Well,
like,
so
I'm struggling
well
to find a low. But I've had a good year, I have to say.
And you're going to go to college, I think, aren't you? Hoping to go
back
to
I'm
college?
Hoping to go back now, next year. So hopefully,
Great to you. And have you thought about what you're going to study?
Yeah, I'd like to go back and study law.
That'd be great.
Amazing.
Yeah. Oh, you'd be so good.
I don't know where I'd like to take it, but I definitely
always do
want
better.
To go
I work
back.
In adult education. So.
Yeah, oh, really? Oh, that's good to hear.
Yeah.
It's been something I've been thinking about for ages, but... it's like everything else. Fear stops you from doing everything, doesn't it? And you kind of, I've been thinking about it and then saying, oh no, I won't, because what if I fail, or what if I can't manage with the kids, or... But sure, I always manage, you know. Yeah. I just,
yeah. You'd be a great lawyer.
I'm just going to put my name down and see how it goes.
Yeah. And you, Vicky, feeling? I mean,
well, I have to say the repeal movement for me on a kind of, you know, just national level. I mean, I remember, it's like those things, you know, I remember where I was when Princess Diana died, yes, for example. Yeah. Yeah. I remember exactly where I was when the vote was in. We were away for the weekend in Connemara and there was no bloody signal and I had to go out into the side of the road with the phone like this waiting for, oh my God. And I, you know, I just remember that feeling of God, you know, and I thought, we can do this, you know, if we can do this for this, yeah, we can do it for, you know, because at that stage, my story was only starting to come out. So I thought, right, they, you know, women are behind me. I can't, you know, it kind of gave me that push. That decision, I just thought, you know, the women of Ireland want change. And that was what made me kind of think, right, let's just keep going and do this. So that was a kind of a big high. But personally, I suppose my big high is I'm here. Like that, there is no, and it's like what you said, Jessica, it's the simple things. I am just so delighted to wake up every day, bring my kids to school, you know, do the normal stuff. It's not even the big stuff that I, you know, it's just to be able to do those things because, you know, I'm in and out of hospital, you know, every couple of weeks and you see very sick people and I've been there and I don't want to go back there, you know. So, I mean, for me, it's the simple things just to be here for Christmas, which I didn't think I would be. The lows, I suppose, the only low I've had this year is just the impact it's had on my kids. I mean, the kids knew my cancer was back. I've always been very honest. They've always been told everything. But the fact that they had to be told, well, my son found out in the playground that, you know, Mammy was going to die, you know, and this was at a time when I really didn't know how things were going to work out. So that has been a really a low for me this year, particularly with my son. My daughter is older. She's 13, so she's able to take that on board a bit easier. And she's very medicalized. She's got her own medical issues, like tons going on. So she's used to, you know, going in and out of hospitals, so it was easier to explain it to her. But he's only 7, and you know, he's real like typical. I don't know, you've got a boy, yeah, haven't you? Like, literally, I
they love their mammies.
They just like, if he could crawl back in, he'd crawl back in, you know. Do you know that kind of way? He's just, he's a real mammy's boy, so he's just been very clingy. That's why he doesn't like me being gone away for too long. He has to know I'm coming back because that's obviously at the back of his mind, you know. So that's been the only low, I suppose, just for the kids, really, you know, as a mother.
But look, as I said at the beginning, you look so healthy and you are doing great. And it's been a privilege for me today to be in this room of five extraordinary women.
Yeah. Can't wait to be with you too, because you're also a very extraordinary woman.
Yes,
Eamonn McGlaizit, Sarah Breen, Vicky Phelan, Alva Smith, Jessica Bowes, thanks also much for being my guest today. It's been my privilege.
RTE Radio 1.